We're focusing the entire hour this week on the powerful and remarkably secretive efforts to bring American-style politicized homeschooling ideology and practice to nations across the globe. My next guest was a presenter at a recent online conference focusing on religion as a driving force in what is being called anti-genderism in various parts of the world. Dr. Christina Stokoe spoke about the unexpected places she keeps finding U.S.-crafted and U.S.-funded homeschooling movements in Europe, Russia, and beyond. And it was this presentation that initially prompted us to focus on this phenomenon, and in particular, on the incessant denial most Americans and others seem to be in when it comes to the origins of this anything but grassroots movement. We reached her in Innsbruck, Austria. Christina, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your field of study is really pretty far removed from the topic of homeschooling, especially of American origin. How did you first engage with this movement?
It is true that I did not expect to end up doing research on homeschooling. I'm a sociologist of religion, and my area of expertise is Russian Orthodoxy. And I was doing a research project on the discourse on human rights inside the Russian Orthodox Church. And at one point during that research, I came across organizations that engage on behalf of pro-family issues in the language of human rights. And this in itself was interesting because the Russian Orthodox Church does not usually use a modern language to address social ethics. Russian Orthodoxy generally, theologically, is not prepared well, let's say, to address issues of social ethics. And as I'm a sociologist, we also did field work. And we attended a pro-family congress in the city of Tbilisi in Georgia. And there were participants from the United States, the International Organization of Family, Alliance Defending Freedom, the World Congress of Families, and participants from Russia. And one of the topics that was discussed there was homeschooling. And the American guests presented the benefits of homeschooling, and they also presented the benefits of homeschooling curricula to their East European and Russian hosts. And so this is when I realized that that's an interesting topic we should follow up on.
So what were the first signs for you that this was not the innocent grassroots initiative it pretends to be?
Well, first of all, I realized that this is very much against, it's a very new phenomenon in Europe because unlike in Europe, we are accustomed to having confessional private schools, Catholic private schools or Protestant private schools, they are very common. But homeschooling for religious reasons is actually very uncommon. And it's even something that goes against the wishes of most of the official churches. So the Catholic Church in many countries, they're happy with their right to have publicly recognized private schools. They also get tax money for running them. Homeschooling is a very different vision of the role of religion in the public sphere, because it's a vision of religion that sort of goes into a fortress, and that fortress is called family. So this is, I think, one aspect that I thought was noteworthy. And the second is, of course, the vision of family that is constructed around the idea of homeschooling, mm-hmm. namely the family as a fortress, the family as a place where the state does not rule into And this then extends to other questions, to children's rights, issues of domestic violence, issues of taxation of families, split taxation, shared taxation between spouses. So a lot of questions connect to family, and homeschooling is one access to the topic.
This is particularly noteworthy in Orthodox Christian circles, your area of expertise, because, as you pointed out, these are not communities ordinarily prone to ecumenical engagement. That may be an understatement.
Exactly, exactly. This is also a very interesting part because, as I told you, our fieldwork started in Georgia. And the Georgian Orthodox Church has withdrawn from the World Council of Churches because it does not engage in any ecumenical activity. Now, the Russian Orthodox Church is still a part of the World Council of Churches, but generally the Orthodox grassroots are very anti-ecumenical. They're very suspicious vis-a-vis Western Christians. And there you get occasions of gathering, as I would say these congresses are, where you have interconfessional meetings that are very easy. But of course, they proceed without theology, I would say. They also proceed without liturgies, for example. So it's a very conference-like setting. It's very business-like also. Yeah. And I would even say that the confessional aspect is played down because for an Orthodox audience, the foreign origin, sort of the non-Orthodox origin of some of these ideas could be irritating. So it's being played down. And as I said, one thing I also found very striking is that an Orthodox homeschooling curriculum has now been published, and it is a translation of an American curriculum, of the Classical Conversations curriculum. It's been franchised to Russia now. It's been franchised before to Brazil, by the way. It's not the first time that they're translating it. And so now you have a Russian curriculum that is based on a North American model. And also here, if you go to the website, that is not being made apparent, because for a Russian audience, that probably would not be very attractive to make that too apparent.
Well, so now that you are familiar with this, more familiar with this, what do you see in the unusual connections being made?
Well, I think we have to see that in the bigger context of the transition of Europe, especially of post-communist Europe after the end of communism. So, of course, we had a situation of societies that were in a situation of transition and reorientation on all aspects, economically, socially, politically. And sort of social values and questions of coherence and what defines us as a society and also what defines a family were kind of up to negotiation. And I think that many people in the West, they kind of too quickly assumed that the attractive ideas were democracy and liberty and individual human rights. But this is not what has happened. I think also ideas of community are obviously of a great attraction, of democracy, but in a very grounded way, sort of democracy, I'm saying a majoritarian democracy, saying we can discriminate who we want, not a liberal idea of democracy that has guarantees for minorities. And what these connections do, in a way, they provide a language for that. Mm-hmm. They provide a language that warns interlocutors in the East, in Eastern Europe, who are ready to listen against what they call the ills of liberal democracy. Mm. They very clearly say that. And they alert them to another side of being modern, namely being modern conservatives, that use the language of human rights. They are a complete worldview that is exclusionary, hierarchical, in many ways patriarchal, and complete. So I think that's the other thing.
Yeah.
It's in itself. It's a complete and a coherent worldview that is made attractive, and Europe and, as I said, the EU. They were too optimistic, thinking that what the EU represents was the only thing and was the only thing attractive.
As well as you know the communities that we're talking about, how important is it that the foreign sources of this movement remain unknown?
Well, I wouldn't even say that they are hiding them that much. I mean, it's not that if you know, I'm not an investigative journalist. I do qualitative interviews as a sociologist, and people talk to me, and I only do research on published sources or websites, and you find that information. So it's not that the information is completely hidden. But of course, there's also a language barrier. I mean, we have the passage from English to Russian, and this passage, in a way, is also mediated by the people who I call norm entrepreneurs who do that mediation. I give you just two examples from my research on Russia. So the Russian homeschooling curriculum, which is called Classical Conversations Russia, Klassicheskie Besiedy in Russian, it does not have an official blessing of the Russian Orthodox Church. And the Russian Orthodox Church issued a statement saying that this was not an official project of the Patriarchate. So they said that. Another example from the research on Russia is a year ago, the Moscow Patriarchate issued a statement on the question of domestic violence, where it was all around a controversy whether the laws against domestic violence in Russia should be tightened. The church was against that. And it was against that because they said domestic violence is a language that destroys the family. Now, this is a trope that comes straight out of a Christian right discourse. It's a language that we find all across countries and churches that are very conservative and anti-liberal. And the document quoted a Western, an American source. So it's not that. So someone who went to see the footnotes would have realized the source. And this was in a Russian text. So again, as I said, it's not that this is so hidden. To some extent, it's quite obvious. But of course, you have to be interested in it to see it.
Yeah.
You know, in Russia, there is a law against foreign agents. So groups that receive financing from abroad have to be registered with the Russian government as foreign agents. And this is widely interpreted as a law to curtail liberal civil society. And organizations like Open Society Institute or the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung from Germany, they have fallen victim of that law. But here we, of course, do have organizations from the West that have relations with organizations in Russia. But for some reason, they don't seem to fall under that close observance that law has afforded.
Hmm. Christina, what's possible in terms of networking and collaboration among cultural conservatives around homeschooling that might otherwise might not be going on?
But I think there are concrete goals they have. I mean, for example, they have a concrete goal that the European Court of Human Rights will express itself in favor of homeschooling. Germany is one of the few countries where homeschooling is completely forbidden. And the American association law firm, Alliance Defending Freedom, has brought a case of a German homeschooling family to the Court of Strasbourg, hoping that Strasbourg would condemn Germany for a violation of human rights because it has a law that prohibits homeschooling. Strasbourg did not do that. But that was the aim. So it was a clear legal strategy. So these are, the immediate goals. The wider implication of this, I think, is that a whole debate on human rights and what they mean is altered. Mm-hmm. So to which areas do human rights extend? Do they extend into the family? Do they extend to non-discrimination on the basis of gender in all respects when it comes to family law, to adoption, and so on? So I think what's happening here is that languages, the language of human rights or human rights as such should again be restricted. It's a, that is a political strategy. And it can be built around many issues. It can be built around homeschooling. It can be built around questions of abortion. It can be built around questions of domestic violence, children's rights. I mean, religious freedom. It can be built around many things. So it's very much a question of who has the right to define human rights.
Yeah. Can you talk about how appealing this movement seems to be to diverse people in different countries and why you think that is? What void is being filled by this?
We still have to see this in the optic of a post-communist transition. I'm speaking about Europe now, and about the expansion of the European Union to countries in Eastern and Central Europe. For the countries in Central and Eastern Europe, EU accession in many ways was a very desired step, but it has also meant giving up legal sovereignty. They're now part of a larger political union. And political parties on the right in all these countries have resented this step, and they are now rather anti-EU in their attitude. Mm-hmm. The counter model to the EU in this moment is Russia, which is the country that is that of strong national sovereignty, non-interference, and aggressive also military defense of territorial non-interference, and even it's expensive. I mean, it's waging a war in Ukraine, and it has the annexation of Crimea. So Russia has affirmed itself as a very strong player in the region against the EU. So I think, in a way, what we have, at least in Europe, is really, it's two visions of politics. One, a politics of liberal democracy, and a politics of what the Hungarian Orban government calls sovereign democracy. So, and I think it's these two systems, in a way, that are being confronted. And the Christian right in the US, I think there's one thing which I find always very important. In the United States, you have had a conflict between progressive and conservative groups inside the country for decades. And it's happening within one polity that has a constitution, that has functioning institutions, and that has elections. And it has institutions that keep the whole thing together. But once this plays out globally, there is no global system that keeps it all together. So this really develops very divisive dynamics between countries.
What do you say to your colleagues about what you're finding in this whole discovery?
First of all, we have to rethink the conservative turn inside Russia. Again, I said, I'm a scholar of Russian studies, and I also speak to the Russian community. And there is a tendency to think about the traditional turn or the conservative turn that Russia has taken under Vladimir Putin in the last 10 years as something genuinely Russian, as Russia finding back to its roots. I think this has to be completely revisited, because the Russian conservative turn is embedded in the transnational phenomenon of a globalizing culture wars. That's the first point. And the second point is that we have to become accustomed to the religious landscape globally readjusting, and we are no longer dealing with sort of the main conflicts are no longer between the confessions. They are inside the confessions, between conservative groups and progressive groups. And conservatives across confessions relate in type of conservative ecumenism, and the divisions inside the churches grow. That's true for the Orthodox Church, and it's also true for the Catholic Church, which are the sort of the two universes I observe most.
So do people who are buying into this and using this for their own purposes, how do they see religion and politics? Do they divide it? Do they put them together? How do they come at this?
They see religion and politics as very much related because they interpret religion in terms of culture, of national culture, or ethnic culture. So if you look at the groups that join these transnational conservative movements in Europe and in Russia, these are groups on the political right. In Western Europe, they tend to be very anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim migration. So they say we have to defend Christian Europe and we have to go back to sort of our Christian values, which are the ones of the family. And, you know, even better, defend them as homeschoolers. So this is one motive, a very close sort of Christian national identity. And in the Russian case, it's the same. It's sort of Russia as an Orthodox country that is different from the West.
Christina, what do you consider to be the most dangerous features of this movement, both in any particular place and are across the globe?
Well, you know, generally, I think that polarization is dangerous for societies. A very deep polarization on values and on politics. And it's polarization is something that's very difficult to overcome. And you have to mobilize, every community has to mobilize its own resources to overcome polarization by drawing on its own narratives, on its own experiences, and on something that is shared in that community. So I think the danger of a transnational global agenda of anti-liberalism, but even of pro-liberalism, is that communities no longer talk to each other on their own issues and on their own questions, but they launch out at each other with arguments that are kind of copy-paste from different contexts. And so they no longer understand each other. And again, I want to give the example of domestic violence. I mean, domestic violence is a problem in each and every society, but it's a huge problem in Russia. And it's no use speaking about domestic violence in the Russian context, saying, well, this is an attack on the family, because as we see in the human rights language in the UN, that's how it's used. It's no use. It will only lead to people no longer understanding each other. And I think this is really the most dangerous. It's a conversation stopper in democratic contexts.
You are right into understanding what's happening here. What's going to happen as you see it? Is this going to prosper and be very difficult, or is it going to fade away? What's going to happen?
No, I'm not optimistic. I think we are just seeing the beginning of it. I think we are going to see more polarization around many more issues. So in that sense, I think it's good to do research on this, to draw people's attention to it. And that's my task as a researcher. But at the point I stand, where I stand right now, I'm not so optimistic that there will be a way out of polarization soon.
Hmm. Dr. Christina Strukel is professor of sociology at the University of Innsbruck. She is currently principal investigator of the European Research Council-funded research project, POSEC, Post-Secular Conflicts. We reached Dr. Strukel in Innsbruck, Austria. Christina, I can't tell you how grateful we are for you coming to us with this important work, your understanding of it, and for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.